Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 13th of October 2018. We're halfway through, probably episode 5. Just stop a bit from here to there, do bits of programming, go out and do various things. So we're neatly behind. I've got another New Scientist there sitting ready to be read, and probably yet another one will be delivered today. So better get going. Now, this article is one of these feature articles by Ed Gent, Big Black Box. We're on the verge of building an exascale computer, whatever that is. But what does it mean, and will we even be able to use it? There are a few events in the universe more complex than the violent deaths of massive stars. The explosions are so huge that they can be seen thousands of light years away, and they leave behind mind-bending remnants like black holes and neutron stars. Making detailed simulations of these colossal supernovas is currently beyond the reach of even the world's most powerful computers, yet Professor Messer is determined to try. It's the biggest bucket of physics you can imagine, says Messer, an astrophysicist of Oak Ridge National Laboratory, ORNL, in Tennessee. Tennessee is from Oak Ridge, which is the second last element. I find these things I've got to get into. Could you go in quantum mechanics calculations required supercomputers, but I just trying to imagine what could be so complex about these calculations. Messer is building simulations for Aurora, due to come online in the early 2020s, which will be the first machine capable of an exaflop, a billion floating point operations per second, making it millions of times faster than your trusty laptop. Exascale computers will provide unprecedented power, perhaps enough to unlock fundamental goals in a broad range of scientific disciplines. Predicting the weather, simulating entire brains, recreating the cosmos, and tailoring drugs into individuals could become possible. This is why the US, China, and Japan are racing to build the first one. This is a multi-billion dollar development effort fueled by the need to power such a beast of a machine without bringing the grid to its needs, to create a communication network that can coordinate all of its many parts. But lurking in the background is a provocative question with no clear answer. Once we build such a machine, how useful will it be? Need for speed. The accepted way of ranking the speed of a computer is how many calculations it can perform in a second. These ordinarily involve representing numbers in a format known as floating point, which can be... I've got a bee attacking me at the moment. Come off it. Jeez, it's pretty scary. Okay. It allows you to efficiently encode numbers both large and small, so that's e to the something or other. A scientific number is... Well, it's only one decimal point, but then you've got an exponential. So there's actually, there's a sign number, the decimal, the number, and an exponential number. So it's actually interesting. The calculator on your desk drawer probably boasts a handful of floating point operations per second flops. The cutting edge phone in your pocket, several billion, and the world's fastest machines, collectively known as supercomputers, millions of times or more. Although the first machines to tick over an exaflop mark should arrive sometime in the next 3 years, it isn't going to solve all the world's problems overnight. Quote, there's nothing magical about certain numbers, says Simon McIntosh-Smith, a high-performance computing researcher at the University of Bristol, UK. Reaching that milestone, however, will push current technology to the limit. It's going to much beyond, may require rethinking paradigms and that got us this far. For more than half a century, the key increasing computing power has been squeezed ever more transistors into a chip. Since the 60s, the density has doubled roughly every 18 months. It's going to be Moore's Law, isn't it? And producing an exponential increase in performance known as Moore's Law, after the chips company's Intel co-founder, Gordon Moore, who was the first person to notice it. In 1974, computer scientist Robert Dennard made another important prediction, noting that chips shrank so their power consumption stayed in proportion with their area. Even as transistors' density increased, this means the power consumed by a set number of transistors halved every cycle of Moore's law. Engineers used this headroom for decades to make chips run faster without significantly increasing the power consumption. But that trend broke down mid-2000s. Dennard's assumptions ignored the baseline power that even the smallest transistor must use. That forced a major rethink. Chip makers realized they could put multiple processors or silicon brains that carry out instructions from software on a single chip. This these mini processors is called a core. Splitting programs into chunks and running them in parallel, and these cores make computers solve problems faster without boosting the speed of individual parts, which should also boost power consumption. Even the most basic laptop processor today features at least two cores, but the world's fastest machine, Summit, which ONNL turned on in June, has more than 2 million. More recently, the drive for energy efficiency has also fueled the use of accelerators. Remember the turbocharge? There was chips you could do, you can overdrive your computer. What was it? There's a special chip, turbo chip, I think you used to put in your computers, the old 100 megahertz computers. Specialized devices to carry out certain tasks much more efficiently in general purpose processors. GPUs, originally designed for render graphics, but now widely used for artificial intelligence, was one popular variety. Now that's an interesting thing. I really have to understand artificial intelligence. I cannot get my mind fully around that one, mate. They excel in running parallel tasks at low power and are increasingly finding their way into supercomputers. Summit has more than 27,000 of them. Well, that's like a nothing drop in the... Oh, no, that's a drop in the block bucket because it's got 2,000 processors. So that's 27... That's 1% of them are like that. But all this can only take so far. If for some magical reason you actually build an exascale machine from today's technology, nobody could afford to power it, says McIntosh Smith. Such a behemoth would need hundreds of megawatts, he says. As a rule of thumb, 1 megawatt, about $1 million a year. Even if the chips are more energy efficient, having more of them means your rack up bills elsewhere, significantly sending signals from one part of the machine to another. Quote, moving data within large-scale computer systems consumes over an order of magnitude more energy than is needed to compute the data, says a market. Vilbil, who leads the exascale program at computer manufacturer Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. Because power consumption rises rapidly with distance when communicating over electrical cables, fiber optics have become the go-to approach for moving large volumes of data between distant clusters of processors within supercomputers. But the exascale, the cumulative cost of signaling over even a millimeter length, will be a problem. That's a bit of confusion. Why is that? Why would it be a millimeter? Why is that a problem? One potentially revolutionary technology known as silicon photonics is allowing us to integrate tiny lasers directly onto chips. That just defies my... Hasn't most silicon chips got lasers in them? How could... That could make communication essentially distance independent, says photonics researcher Karen Bergman of Columbia University in New York. Commercial products of this type have just started appearing, but it's unclear whether they'll feature in the first scale machines. Quote, we can probably just reach over the finish line with the technologies we have on hand, she says, but not have legs beyond that. Photonics is clearly going to be the next integral part. For all its importance, energy efficiency is only part of the communication problem. Having more processors is of little use if they are starved for data, and increases in flops have been outstripping data movement speeds for some time. Silicon photonics could boost the volume of data that can be shuttered per second by at least a factor of 5, says Bergman. But faster conventional optics are needed to in the meantime. The memory chips will also be stacked vertically, an arrangement that can be boost both speed and power efficiency, but typically costs more and comes in smaller capacity. representing a tricking balancing act for computer designers. I must admit, I'm yet to see something photonic-wise impresses me in terms of speed compared to a resistor. Oh yes, so Xa is actually a type of Xa is 10^18, so that's a billion, billion, billion. Now, what I have to really get my brain around here is, I remember the Iliac doing a gigaflop. Now, oh, and look, iMac Pro. Oh my God, what, this is just, I don't believe this. Samsung Galaxy phone is, oh, amazing. Look, I have to really get my head around this. And the A21 US is in the 2020s. Whatever that means. These are computers. This is the year and the processing speed. Which is that normally you need, it's a log scale on the vertical scale, a linear scale on the bottom scale. Normally it's log if you want it for a line. So what's going on here and why it's going, sociological thing. Parallel universe quote. Let's talk about this. Nonetheless, most experts say the roadmap for exascale hardware is fairly well laid down. What may be trickier is building software and algorithms to run potentially billions of cores. Generations of supercomputers leaves some users behind, says Tim Kropp, director of US National Center for Supercomputing Applications in Illinois. That's been a constant problem, and I don't think we're going to see it again. What? The trouble is the inherent weakness in parallelism, noted in 1967 by computer scientist Gene Amdahl. His Spinner's Law says that any program speed will always be limited by the least parallel path, which is like path programming. That would make sense, like, it's the slowest member in the team. Grop compares it to transporting plane loads of passengers from Chicago to New York. Even if you replace the flight with instant teleportation, you will still take each papers to clear passenger to take to clear the journal, but that's sequential. Moron. It really, in reality, there are workarounds. As you increase the number of parallel tasks on the go, time spent on the slowest part represents the ever less of a limitation. Well, that is, I must admit, parallel programming is a little bit about how I plan life, basically, or plan programming. Program in parallel problems, and then walk back in, and so I get across the line, and then start knocking off the longest paths. But there are hard limits to how many chunks some problems can be split into, says Grop, and the complexity of massively parallel models can be difficult to understand. We're running out of parallelism, says Misser, and Mr. Arnott pokes his head up even once in a while. We try our best to push him back down, but he never goes away. Messer is confident that would-be supernova simulators have enough tricks up their sleeves to get their models working on exascale machines, and he thinks most developers will experience the world's biggest supercomputers will adapt to. But further progress may require disruptive overhauls of code and programmers' attitudes. Messer thinks one way forward may be to split problems into smallest possible subtasks and let the machine decide how to divvy them up between processes. But that can make it hard to follow the program's actually doing, which makes tracking bugs tricky and can present fundamental challenges when running physical simulations. A program that reproduces a specific phenomena but with underlying steps we struggle to understand is unlikely to provide much insight. Quote, a black box that just gives you the answer is hardly useful as a scientific exercise, he says. sort of see where they're coming from. Let's read this out here. Oh, this is interesting. It's actually not a crack. It's some reason they've got this piece of graphic here, which is... And no matter how perfectly parallel your application is, it still needs to occasionally compare notes between processes, meaning the speed restrictions due to data movement read up again. One way to determine the problem is to find extra work to do while the information is being shuffled around. Messer's supernova simulations are a case in point. They split the star into chunks that can be simulated separately, but calculating the impact of gravity at each step of time requires every processor to broadcast the mass of its chunk to all the rest. While waiting for this to finish, Messer and his group realize each process could happily turn to chunk-specific problems that do not depend on gravity, like the rate at which other elements are fusing into heavier ones. Brain simulations pose similar problems because each neuron connects to so many others. At Jurich Institute, whatever that is, in J-U-D-I-R-I-C-H, probably Germany with the J-U-D-I-R-I-C-H, they put the Germans, have the Germans and Dutch put the W. So, it's interesting. Oh yes, Institute of Neuroscience in Germany, researchers have built models that send every simulated neuron's output across the entire network. This approach works fine at the petascale, millions of billions of flops, but I simply devote too much time and memory at the exascale. So the team has developed a way to determine at the outset which neurons need to share activity data, a shortcut which would let them run a full brain. That's amazing. I don't know what you want to do. A full brain. Let me go. Simulations on exascale machines. Then it becomes a really useful research tool for scientists and not only a technology demonstration, says Marcus Desmond, director of INM's Computational Neuroscience Division. For other simulations, the transition to exascale could be much more of a struggle. At the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, ECMWF, in Reading, UK, two petascale machines provide 22 countries with 15-day weather forecasts. The software stretches to millions of lines of code built up over decades, and the forecasting models rely on algorithms building blocks that deal with very different physical processes. Some are inherently hard to parallelize, others are faster than parallel alternatives at petascale, but will start lagging behind once the upgrade to exascale kicks in. Peter Burr of ECMWF thinks its flexibility will clear to revamping the code. If, hypothetically, you can get more regional detail at the cost of your model's overall accuracy, that trade-off will be well worth making. He says that they will also need new software tools that seamlessly adapt models to run on unprecedented diversity of hardware expected in the exascale machines. The booming field of artificial intelligence is offering further workarounds. Neural network calculations run at half the precision of conventional supercomputer code, but can produce usable approximations faster and more efficiently. Why? What is half the precision? What does it mean? That sentence does not make sense to me. What does the calculation half the precision mean? Rick Stevens of Arca National Laboratory in Illinois is developing deep learning models for Aurora supercomputer to predict how drugs can affect different cancers. Something that could turbocharge drug development and personalized medicines. Stevens says, machine learning is particularly promising in areas with lots of data but little theory to help develop traditional simulations. I sort of see that. I think we are just starting to understand how broadly applicable it is, he says, whatever that means. I don't actually understand this. But there is a deeper question to confront in the exascale race. Whether to focus on flops is always the best way to improve performance. Many simulations use less than a tenth of the supercomputer's peak capacity. Meanwhile, the ability to move data is largely ignored in ranking the world's top-performing machines, even though it is often the limiting factor for science applications. Supercomputing emergences as the 21st century equivalent of the space race could be an exhilarating problem. Oh, yeah. Listen. One small step, switched it on. Oh, it's calculated. It's one of the things is that these things do calculate. They may take a day, but it's a relatively short time to get your answer out. Supercomputer, my concerns here is that preoccupation with the race, the geopolitical posturing here, may ultimately lead to exascale systems that are not best for what researchers need to do their jobs, says supercomputing consultant Bob Sorensen. Okay, you're a bit of killjoy. Satoshi Matsuoka, who leads development of Japan's exascale machine, says the country has deliberately set different goals. The idea is to run the application to 100 times faster than their existing K supercomputer, a 10 petaflop machine, by focusing development on data movement rather than raw flops. He says candidly that the post-K computer, will not hit one exaflop. Okay, well, but he was also confident it will run science applications faster than completing first-generation exascale machines. Okay, I just got to say, what the heck? Doug Kurth of ONRL, who leads the US Exascale Computing Project, doesn't think the exascale race will compromise the real-world performance of machines that emerge. Although the US is chasing one exaflop, it is also targeting a 50 times speed. Oh my god. In applications with its 17.6 petaflop Titan supercomputer. With the right priorities, says Cole, the first wave of exascale platforms will not be stunted systems. They can only run a limited number of niche applications. As for what might come after exascale, things may look wide open. In an era where Moore's Law is starting to fall down, many predict even more specialized hardware. Future supercomputers could contain a broader variety of processes and architectures than ever before, or even look entirely different. See the article about quantum, which I'll read next. If Messner wants to keep watching stars explode, his job is going to get a whole lot more complicated. Yeah, that last paragraph doesn't hit sense. Supercomputers are going to fix everything. The exaflop supercomputers are just really, really good. And if he wants to, I don't know, that really hurts my head reading that. What about quantum? Even the world's fastest computer sees the main story, it might one day be obsolete. Enter quantum computers. Instead of encoding information the same way ordinary computers do, these machines could harness the weird quantum effects to let them quickly solve problems that would take millions of years or even the fastest classical computers, or can be actually insoluble. So I don't necessarily think they compete. They can actually do certain things more better. The same quantum quirks may limit the tasks they can perform, but within 5 years they should be able to compete with their classical counterparts on the problems like computer simulations, material modelling and optimization, says John Morton, a quantum computing researcher at the University College of London. Morton thinks they will probably solve the first problem beyond the reach of quantum computers within 12 months. While this first test is likely to be designed to favour quantum computers, he says, this milestone will mark the start of a new era, where quantum software tailored to capabilities of early stage quantum hardware can begin to tackle useful problems.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.